Question number one on the breath meditation. If the breath disappears and it's dark, void, but no bliss, should we go back to the breath or wait? I think in older talks you said to go back to the breath. Usually in newer talks, just stay where you are. Don't go anywhere. And enjoy the dark voidness. I love darkness. Nothing's happening there, so my eyes can take a rest. If any of you have the opportunity and you want to get a bit bored over here, you can walk over to Bodhinyana Monastery and you can find my cave. That's where I live when I'm not over here. And you turn all the lights off and it's absolutely dark. There's no light there at all. And it's soundproof. And I love that place. So darkness rocks. So if it's dark, enjoy it. Remember, the most important thing in meditation, as I was saying this morning and also last night, contentment. Just to be happy to be here, wherever that happens to be. And if it's dark, if it's void, what is actually happening there? Another important lesson in meditation. It's like you've got too many lights in this place, but you may have noticed if you're in your hut and you go you go out of your hut to where there's no light. At first, you can't see anything. It takes a few minutes for your eyes to adapt to the more subtle light outside. You know, your pupils dilate. And then after a minute or two, when you go out of a lit room into the darkness, you can start to see shapes, and you can start to see more as your eyes adapt to the more subtle light. And that's what happens when the breath disappears. It's dark void. For the moment, hang out there. Allow the mind to adapt to a more subtle mental object. And after a while, when the mind, like the pupils of the eyes dilate, when the mind becomes more sensitive, then you can see it's not just dark or void. It's beautifully dark, wonderfully void. There's much more things going on in there. But it takes a while. Just stay there for a while, and you'll be able to notice much more. Very similar to when you go out from a lit room into the darkness. First, you can't see anything. Wait for a while, and then your senses become more easy and more able to perceive more subtle objects. So I say, stay where you are. Don't do anything. Next question. Often when I'm having strong meditation sitting, I feel a force in my head around to one side. Sometimes it's just mild and feels like a ripple through my head. Otherwise, it's extreme and twists my neck as far as it will go. There is no pain, and afterwards it is as if nothing had happened. Should I just let it be, or should I gently bring my head to the center so that energies flow properly? Thank you, Ajahn. What might be causing it? It's usually, if it goes this way, it means your head's becoming unscrewed. and if it goes a bit further, it'll fall off. So, be a big... Now, of course, I'm only making that up. All that's really happening is that your body, if it's doing that in some nice meditation, your body needs to do that. Why it needs to do that, I don't know. But look, not in this retreat. In one of the retreats, well, that old retreat center we used to use in North Perth, the old Redemptorist Monastery, where we used to hold our retreats. I opened my eyes one day, during the retreat, and somebody was sitting there. And their body was so contorted. Now, I can't do it, but so like this and all over the place, but twice that amount. And they were meditating there, and I was really concerned. I thought, my goodness, that must hurt. What are they doing that for? So I took them aside afterwards, and I said, look, I opened my eyes when you were meditating, and this was half of what you were doing. And are you okay? And they said, I feel great. I feel wonderful. And that was one of the first times I realized that when you do get into a deep meditation, your body will move around. And it will do what it thinks it needs to open up channels of energy to do healing. That's all it really is. Your body is much smarter than you ever give credit for. And once you get out of the way, and that's what happens in meditation, your body might twist around, and it's probably because you've had some accident there, some injury, and that's the only way that you can move your body to allow energy to flow to that area. So that's what is actually happening. You must have had some sort of injury there in your head or your neck, car accident, whiplash, or when you were a kid, fell off your rocking chair or whatever. No, not rocking chair, that's what you have when you're old. We know what I mean, you fell off something. And then this is actually some injury, and this is just a healing happening. The most important thing of this is, yeah, you do go into really weird postures, a force forcing your head around to one side. The most important thing, you feel great afterwards. No pain, and you actually feel even better. They feel some more loose, and tensions have disappeared. So that's why I totally trust my body. It can do whatever it wants, and I let it. And I know that it's because it needs to do that. So probably some injury in the past, so just let it go. Don't even worry about it. You'll be fine. Anyone having any questions about that? Okay. Please talk about walking meditation. Okay. Keep it simple. First, you move one leg, then you move the other leg. Nice and easy. Now with walking meditation. You know, it's really hard to sit all the time, to sit hour after hour after hour after hour. So you can balance the sitting meditation with the walking meditation. So you can either use one of the three rooms, you know, which we've got these amazing walking meditation paths. I said the red carpet treatment for you. So the reason we put those red carpets in there is because actually it guides you. That's what you have to walk on. Because if we didn't have those red carpets, there'd be somebody who takes one corner, walks to the other corner. So no one else would be able to use that room at all. So by putting those carpets there, you know, you have to put on the carpet. You can't walk, you know, crosswise. So it means that many, many people can walk meditation in there. And if someone else is walking meditation in there, remember, it's not a competition of who can walk the slowest. Which is sometimes happens, you know, you're walking there and someone else says, they're going really slow, I better slow down a bit. So it's nothing to do with that. You don't have to walk slow, you don't have to walk fast. You can just walk at your natural pace. Which reminds me of an old joke. There was, some, many of you have heard this one before, it's a really good, real meditation retreat joke. There's this person, he'd been on a meditation retreat for 9 days. And you do actually find that people do actually slow down. You walk very slowly, you talk very slowly, because you get much more mindful, even picking things up. You pick it up and you notice all these amazing sensations when you pick things up or you put it down again. You do things very slowly. So after the 9-day retreat, the fellow went back to work, and he was working in Perth Zoo. And so when the head keeper saw him, you know, coming to work, walking very slowly and mindfully, he thought, what am I going to do with this guy today? And so he thought he had this brilliant idea. He said, I know, I'm going to put you in charge of the tortoise enclosure. I said, obviously, because the tortoise go really slowly. So if you've been on a meditation retreat, you work in the zoo, that's the best thing to do, you know, look after the tortoises. So he told the head keeper, yes, I will look after the tortoises. And he walked very slowly and mindfully to the tortoise enclosure. And at lunchtime, the head keeper decided to check up on him. And there he was, in front of the tortoise enclosure, with the gate open, and all the tortoises had escaped. When the head keeper asked, what happened? Well, said the meditator, I opened the gate and whoosh. That's an old meditation teacher's trick. Because when you really go slow, even tortoises whoosh. So anyway, you can go fast, you can go slow. You know, in the Thai tradition, many people actually, they do walking meditation really fast. So you can do it whichever way you like. Keep it natural. So the most important thing is, when you're doing the walking meditation, it doesn't matter if you're walking fast or slow, number one, present moment awareness. So you're just being here. You're not thinking of where you're going to get to. Because the nice thing about walking meditation you always end up where you started. You don't get anywhere. That's a wonderful thing. No, people actually walk to get somewhere. They walk to get to the shops. You know, they walk to get home. They walk to get to the bus stop. But here, you don't get anywhere. You go to the end, you come back again. You end up where you started. Isn't that brilliant? No attainments, not getting anywhere. It's wonderful to do things without sort of a goal. You're just walking. So, in the present moment, just being here. Number two. Silence. So don't go having a conversation in your head while you're doing the walking. So present moment awareness, silence. And then you can start to feel the sensations in your feet. That's the thing which is moving. Your feet are moving. So just be with the very wonderful feelings of your feet moving, touching the carpet. What does it feel like for the soles of your feet to touch that carpet? Just savor as many sensations as you can. What's it like when the foot moves up from the carpet and moves forward through the air? How does it move through the air? What part of the foot leaves the carpet first? And what part of your foot touches the carpet first? So you get to be really interested in all the movements and sensations in the feet as they're moving. So that becomes your focus. In the present moment, silent, you just go to the end. When you get to the end, you turn around and come back again. It becomes a very peaceful, beautiful meditation. And it's to be encouraged. However, if you find that's difficult because you're not really calm enough yet and you want something else to do, the other type of walking meditation we encourage in this joint is to repeat a little mantra as your walking meditation. And there are many, many mantras which people use when they're doing walking meditation, but the one we recommend here is this. As you move your left foot, say you move, now maybe you move your right foot first of all, the right foot goes forward, and you recite to yourself the words, "I will die." And as the left foot moves, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. Now, it's not just a joke. You think it's funny, but it's great. Try it. Because, yeah, the first stage of that meditation, I will die, that's for sure. This is stupid. This is a joke. And then after, you know, a few backwards and forwards, you think, actually, this is absolutely true. Or the other thing that monk said, you know, maybe right, maybe not right, but that's certainly, I can trust that one. That's Dhamma, that's truth. And I think, my God, that's actually true. I will die, that's for sure. And then that really brings you into this present moment. The next thing you do, you come across fear. You know, yeah, I will die, that's for sure. Are you ready to die yet? Very few people are. I will die, that's for sure. But you carry on walking. And once you've gone past the fear, you have this beautiful sense of freedom. I will die, that's for sure. So what am I worried about all this stuff for? What am I worried about the economy, about family, about health? I'm going to die anyway. So, you know, why do you keep all this health food? You're going to die anyway. Get it out and get over and done with. And die with a happy smile on your face. So what it does, it gets you very detached from most of the things you worry about, trying to keep alive, trying to sort of keep healthy, trying to keep sort of financially solvent, trying to keep your relationships together. They're all going to sort of fade away, disappear. So isn't that wonderful? I will die, that's for sure. I can be totally free. I don't have to worry about anything at all. I will die, that's for sure. So you feel, you go to a place of detachment. Because in the face of, you know, your impending death, what's there to worry about? Nothing. So that actually becomes a very beautiful meditation. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. I will die, that's for sure. And see what happens. But please don't die on this retreat. When you get home, fine. Because it'll be a very big problem for the caretaker. And so is that okay, please? Make a promise. Don't be stubborn. So next question here. As I was taking a walk around the fence perimeter at Jhana Grove, the buzzing flies were plenty. Soon after, I came across a small sign which says, "Monk's Meditation Area, no entry." I don't know that. It's, I haven't seen that before. What is that one? Oh, that's right, yeah. When Sangamaji is. That's right, yeah. That's right, because that's a retreat kuti. My intention was to go one hole big around the fence. I obeyed the sign, but would like to ask, what is beyond the small hillock? Ah, that's the secret. That's where we put all the bad monks. They used to have, I remember just in England where I grew up, used to have these attics, and in all the books I used to read, all the crazy people up in the attic, you know, the uncle who was a bit mad, got locked in the attic. And that's actually this monk. He lives down there. So it's like supposed to be a retreat kuti, where monks can actually have a bit of peace and quiet by themselves. So that's what's there, a nice little hut for monks. But yeah, if you go to the fence line, just stick to the fence line, oh, you know, you can see the hut, but you don't really disturb them. Is that okay? It's okay. So the guy who lives in there says it's okay. But don't go to the door and start knocking on the door. Is it really a beautiful area with beautiful places to meditate? Just curious. Oh, you can just, if you keep to the fence line, you can see it. As I backtrack, I saw a monk or a bhikkhu meditating under a tree near a small creek with a fly net hat. Was that you? That was you? Ah, it's Venerable Bhikkhuni Sudama. She was doing that. So a monk or a bhikkhu meditating under a tree near a small creek with a fly net hat. Even with a hat, how does one concentrate with the buzzing sound of the flies and the insects and the birds? It's easy, look. All it is what Ajahn Chah used to say, it's not the sound of the flies which disturbs you. It's you who disturb the sound of the flies. It's a very beautiful teaching, that. Because the flies just make the sound. You don't worry about it. You don't argue with it. You just let it be and be content with the buzzing sound. You know, a deaf person would be very glad to hear that. So you should be grateful you still have ears to hear those beautiful sounds of the buzz. I know that people have done this. I forget, I think there was the last retreat, could have been the flies. Must have been the mosquitoes or something. They were saying, they were meditating outside, had all these buzzing insects, and then it actually sounded like a symphony. It just their perception changed of something which was irritating to something very beautiful. And they could listen to the amazing sort of symphony of these flies buzzing. It was beautiful. It was actually sonorous. It's just the perception they added to that sound was not, you know, get away, leave me alone, I want to be quiet. It became like, you know, beautiful orchestral music. The fly symphony in B minor. Well, that's actually the bees doing B minor. So it's amazing, just your perception can change. What to many people will be irritating, and to you is actually quite beautiful. So, landing on your face or trying to find a way into your ears, nostrils or mouth. Must we have total silence to be able to concentrate? I'm disturbed by the slightest of sound. Okay, so I remember once, you know what it's like, whenever I say something, it always comes back to bite me. So I was giving the meditation talk on Saturday afternoon in Nolamara one day. And it was one of the days there's lots of flies. Oh, just let the flies do whatever they want, you know, because they're not sort of going to harm you. The flies in Australia are very clean. They don't carry diseases and they're very small. They don't bite you. They just, you know, go for exploratory adventures up your nose. So I said, I'll just leave them alone. And of course, as soon as I said that, a fly landed on my face. So everyone was watching. Is this guy a hypocrite or not? So I just had to let it. So it landed on the tip of my nose and started going around my mouth. And I don't know whether it was doing this out of respect, because in the tradition of Buddhism, you always go around things three times. And I'm not joking, that's what the fly did. It went around three times the mouth. And having completed its circumambulation, it flew off. And you know what I found? I found that this area over here is really sensitive. Up here was okay, but once it got round the corner of the mouth, it was fine. And then it got here, it was really sort of tickly. And then up here was okay. So that part of my mouth, that's the most tickly part. So see if your mouth is the same. Go outside tomorrow afternoon. Find a fly and invite it to circumambulate your mouth. But the point was, you can just stay there and be mindful and just enjoy it. Because, you know, what is the feeling anyway? Why is it irritating? It's only irritating because we don't want it, that's all. So if you just allow it to be, let it be, you're fine. It's only a feeling, it's not that bad. Just let it happen. Let it happen. And that way, you're beginning to learn a lot about your mind. The feeling is not the problem. It is the mind, what we do with that feeling. That is the problem. I don't want this. Ajahn Brahm said these flies, you know, they don't carry diseases. But maybe one does, and maybe that's the one on my mouth right now. Maybe it's got this dengue fever or any other sort of terrible fevers. What's the latest fever going around now? Actually, we haven't got many fevers in Australia. Maybe it's a new one. You're going to... But no, look, it's perfectly safe, so just let it do whatever it wants to do. It's fine. So that's actually how you do it. See how you're reacting, and just be kind. That poor little fly. Imagine what it's like being a fly. No one loves you. It just comes and says hello to you, and you try and swat it away. It just wants a little bit of kindness and compassion. Imagine that was you. Every time you went up to speak to someone, they try to swat you away. You know, you feel rejected. Now, many of those flies must have psychological problems. You know, it's just like a rejected baby, never having a mother, never having someone look after them and be kind to them in their whole life. They'll probably be paranoid, schizophrenic, real psychotic messes, these flies. So I'll be kind to the poor fly. They only live a little while, so give them some fun. No, that's going to happen to me tomorrow, and you'll be watching me, see what I do. Anyway, next question. When doing walking meditation in a room, should I watch, notice the breath or the movement of my leg? Regards, love and metta. Or one more. If I'm watching the movement of my leg, should I notice up and down of my leg or when it touches the floor? You can do all of those. I wouldn't watch the breath when you're doing walking meditation, because if you really watch the breath, you're not really watching your legs, you don't know where you're going, and you bang into the wall. So please just watch your legs, your feet. Just you're walking as mindfully as you possibly can. But also remember, present moment awareness and silence. They're the two main things. So always in the moment, not thinking about what you're going to do next. Not thinking about anything. Just like the simile yesterday or this morning about you're either watching the sunset or you're thinking about the sunset. You're either walking or you're thinking about walking. So just walk, feel it, and let it flow naturally. And that's the way to go. So I wouldn't watch the breath if I was you. Could you please, please, please do some guided meditation on the retreat? Okay, sit down, close your eyes, shut up, open your eyes. Okay, done it. Yeah, well, I always do some guided meditation at the very end of the retreat, but it's very difficult because people like to come and go. So it means everybody has to come in, has to be at a certain time. So look, if you want some guided meditation, ask Danny. Have we got CDs, guided meditation? So you can get a CD player, put it on an iPod, and you can do it yourself. So that's nice and easy. I like the story about the daft boy who was a superb meditator, but can you see any benefits of intelligence to make the smart ones here feel better and prevent lobotomies? No, I can't. Look, in that book, The Opening the Door of Your Heart, there was a poem in there, which I got. It's from Sung Po, a very famous Chinese poet. And if I remember it as best I can, it was called On the Birth of My Son. That was the title. And it went something like this. On the birth of a son, most parents want them to grow up intelligent. But I hope my son turns out stupid. Because I, through intelligence, have wrecked my whole life. If my son is stupid, then he'll have a very tranquil life and complete his peaceful existence by becoming a cabinet minister. Because that's where most stupid people end up, it seems. But it was a very beautiful, because sometimes intelligence, you know, we praise intelligence, but sometimes it drives people crazy, because intelligence is not wisdom. Intelligence means you're a very powerful thinker, but you don't see the truth of anything. That's why sometimes intelligence, the way that we... Look, I had a big degree from a great university, and then went over to Thailand and met someone like an Ajahn Chah, 4 years at school. And after a week staying with that monk, it was very clear to me who was intelligent, who was stupid. I was the stupid one. And I thought, what is going on? All that hard work at school, at university, and I was nowhere near as intelligent as a fellow just done 4 years at school. That really made me doubt, you know, our system of education. Yeah, it teaches us to know a lot of things, but to understand very little. It's the trouble with education. You know, we just, it's old people's knowledge. We're told what to believe. And very rarely are we asked to challenge anything and to inquire. And you know, that's a way to be wise, to ask questions, challenge yourself as well. Ask the questions, see differently. I often say that, you know, monks and bhikkhunis, we can think out of the box because we live out of the box. You know, we're not in the normal way of living. Sometimes it's very hard being a monk because, you know, for example, sometimes, you know, to do something you need proof of identity. And proof of identity means, you know, can we see your social security card? Don't have one. Your marriage license? Don't have that. Driving license? No. Bank account details? No. Credit card? No. So as a monk in many systems, same in the US I'd imagine, but certainly in Australia, you don't exist. You're off the record. I haven't got a tax file number. Because I don't earn any money, so you don't have a tax file number. So in many, many ways, you're just off the radar of the government. You don't exist. Which is, you know, very great until sometimes you have to prove evidence that you are who you are. You know what I did once? I was checking in at the airport, and you know, it was a domestic flight, so I didn't have enough ID. So they said, we can't let you on the flight. But you know what I had? I had a copy of my book. And they had a photo of me. It said, look, see, this is my book, this is me, see? And that got me on the flight, because it's photo ID. And I was very fortunate, I was just carrying a couple of copies to give away. So sometimes that's what actually happens. So a lot of times it's nice just being simple. Because all intelligence does, it just thinks old thoughts, carries on in old ways, and you really have to think something different. Look, this is a deep simile. Like becoming enlightened. You know that people strive for years, they're trying to get enlightened. But what it truly is like crossing the stream. That's how the Buddha used to describe it, crossing the stream. And it's not a very wide stream. You can actually step over it. The trouble is we always go in the same direction, going upstream or downstream, upstream or downstream. We never actually learn how to go in this other direction, just to cross. And that crossing is just letting go. But we don't know how to let go. We're always trying. You tell people to let go and they try to let go. Come on, let go. Come on, I'm going to let go now. I really am going to let go. That's not letting go. That's doing more things. It's still going in the same direction, doing more of the same. And that's the reason why people don't get anywhere in their meditation. It's just more of the same, more of the same, more of the same. More desire, more craving, attaining more things, doing more things. And the opposite direction is very radical. Sit here and doing absolutely nothing. I'll fall asleep. I'll go restless. It'll get even worse. Do it differently. Not more of the same. Not just the way you live your life. Struggle, strive, make it work, make it happen. This is not a personal attainment. It's where your ego, vanishes and disappears. You're not there anymore. And that means that you have to totally let go of this will, this doing, and be still and see things disappear. It's a different direction. And that's why you have to, you know, live out of the box, think out of the box, do out of the box. And your intelligence has actually got you into a one-track mind. Are you doing things in a certain way? And to get that enlightenment, you have to put all that aside, let it totally go, and do something radical and different. Not to think like other people, not to imitate anybody, not even Ajahn Brahm. If you try and do it my way, no, it's just more doing. Totally let go, abandon everything, vanish. That's how enlightenment happens. You feel like you've been going up the stream, down the stream, never getting across. You just turn around in a direction never gone before, perpendicular. You just step over. It's as simple as that. You realize that's letting go. You're disappearing. No more ego, no more me. Is it okay to make a few notes of the talks afterwards? I have the talks yet, but don't make bank notes. Or is it like saying, oh, what a beautiful sunset? Well, you can make some notes if you like, but you know, really, anything important you'll remember. It's an amazing thing that, you know, I was with this great teacher, Ajahn Chah, for many years, and some of the things he said, I forgot about. They didn't make any sense to me until many years later. Then I remembered them. I never tried to remember them. As if what was actually you heard, if it was very profound, got stored in your head. And when the right time, it comes out again. So just that simile of like going up and down the stream, and the correct way is going perpendicular, doing something you've never ever done before, which goes totally against all of your habits. You just do that. That simile you might forget. Later on in your life, you remember it. It just comes up at the right time. So really, you don't have to take notes. It all gets in there. And the... Okay, it's a nice profound night tonight. One of the most profound things which I heard from Ajahn Chah, and which I didn't understand at all, I thought it was crazy, because this was the first months I was... It was the first year, the first few months I went to stay with him. And he kept on giving this same old simile for the first couple of weeks or months, and then he sort of never said it again. And it was only years later I remembered that and remembered, you know, why I didn't understand it, because, you know, it was just too profound for me. And later on, when you get some better meditation, you understand things more, then it comes up. You say, wow, just how accurate that was. That's a simile of the mango trees. As Ajahn Chah said, his monastery in the northeast of Thailand was a mango orchard. Straight away I thought, what's he talking about? It's not a mango orchard. Now, it's a forest. And then he continued on and said, these mango trees were planted by the Buddha. Oh, come on, the Buddha died 2,500 years ago. He never came to Thailand. I know, you know, everybody wants that he came to Sri Lanka, he came to Thailand. You know, actually, I say he came to Perth. Not, you know, this Buddha, but the previous one, Kassapa, because if you look at the theory of the geotechnics, the tectonic plates, you know, this whole continent of Australia was, I think, called Gondwana land, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. Gondwana land. And it was part of India. This big gap, you know, the Indian Ocean has actually expanded over the centuries. And a long time ago, I don't know many hundreds of thousands of years ago, where Perth is now was actually stuck to India. So where the previous Buddha, you know, was Kassapa, he was supposed to be in India. At that time, Perth was actually joined to India. Not Sydney or Melbourne, no, that's too far away. But Perth. But Perth. Kassapa the Buddha would have walked here because, you know, there was no ocean between them, no desert. It was just next door, literally. So you see, the Buddha has been to Jhanagrove. Bhajan Monastery in Dhammasala. There we go. That's why Dhammasala's got all those nice stupas there. Not the first time. Sorry. Anyway, okay, I'm stretching things a little bit. Maybe stretching things a lot, but you know, we were joined to India some time ago. Anyway, what was I saying? Oh, yeah. So, yeah, the mango trees were planted by the Buddha. That's no way. He said, and all of those trees are all ripe. So there's hundreds, thousands, countless mangoes on every branch and twig of those trees. And they're all ripe and juicy and sweet. He said, all you monks have to do these days, because of the wisdom and compassion of the Buddha, you only have to hold your hand out and a mango will fall. That's all you need to do. And I thought, that's real crazy stuff. Because, yeah, you know, I was born in England, but I spent some time in Asia. I've been to mango orchards. Have you ever tried sitting under a mango tree and holding your hand out? If a mango does fall, it falls on your head, not in your hand, with our luck. I said, what did he mean? It's absolutely crazy stuff, so I forgot it for many years. Then afterwards, you realize what he was saying. He was teaching about letting go. The mango tree, all these amazing teachings, meditation, the Dhamma, the whole lot. It's ripe with these juicy mangoes, the paths and the fruits, the jhanas, enlightenment. It's ripe. It's been planted by the Buddha. And you people these days don't have to climb the tree to get a mango. You don't have to take a stick and throw it up. Or you don't need to shake the mango tree. All you need to do is put out your hand and the mango will fall. You don't need to force your meditation to strive and struggle and shake the mango tree or the Bodhi tree. Don't shake the Bodhi tree. Don't climb up it. Be still. Let go. Just open up your heart, your mind. Let things be. And a mango will fall in. Thank you so much, Buddha. And that's how enlightenment happens. Too many people, they don't get enlightened, they don't get still, they don't get any deep meditations because they keep shaking the damn mango tree. And nothing falls if you keep shaking it, or you climb up it, or whatever you do. Sit still and let go. Open up your mind. And all these beautiful mangoes fall in. That's actually how it happens. It's an incredibly beautiful simile by Ajahn Chah. Anyway, here we go. When observing present moment, I am listening to background noises. I am very sensitive to footsteps. How do I stop listening to them? Thank you. You put toilet paper in your ears. So now, look. Why is it that you may be, say, watching a movie on TV and you don't hear anything? Or you might be watching a football match, if you like football. There's a couple of Sri Lankans here, but you know, you're a nun, you probably don't follow cricket. But many people in Sri Lanka follow cricket. And people have told me this. You know, their husband is watching a cricket match. And the wife comes up and says, your dinner's ready, darling. He doesn't even hear you. Your dinner's ready! He can't hear anything. Because he's so focused on the cricket match that his sound is totally turned off. Wouldn't it be wonderful if you could do that in meditation? It's not as if footsteps, it's someone shouting in your ear. Or the classic story, there was a couple of Malaysian disciples here in Perth, Malaysian Chinese in Perth, and they told me one day they were watching a movie on the TV. Once the movie was finished, one of them went up to go to the toilet, the other one went to put the kettle on and have a cup of tea. And when they got up from the sofa, they all did a double take. Hey, something's strange. There are things missing from the shelf behind the sofa. And there's many more things missing from the whole house. The burglar had been into the house. True story, while they're watching the TV, and it's such a cheeky burglar, had taken stuff from right behind the sofa where they're watching the TV. They hadn't heard anything. And I said, if you could only do that when you were meditating, you know, to be so caught up in the meditation, watching your breath, that someone could get up from behind you, they could walk and you wouldn't hear any footsteps at all. It can be done. And why can you do that when you're watching the TV, but you can't do it when you're watching the breath? What's the difference? Because a TV is interesting and fun. So if you could only get as much fun and interest in your meditation, you'll find you won't hear the footsteps. So remember to put joy into the meditation. To get to that stage where you say, just say, you're watching your breath, and it's just so delightful, so beautiful. Or you're doing walking meditation, you're just having such a good time, you just can't hear other people. It is the joy, what in Buddhism meditation we call the piti sukha. When that joy and happiness starts to come up in meditation, then you don't hear the sounds. You're having such a wonderful time inside, you just can't hear them. And that's actually when the meditation really takes off. So see if you can just develop this beautiful appreciation. I'm so content. I don't need anything, I don't want anything. Just, this is so wonderful, just be able to sit meditation and you don't have to achieve anything. As I mentioned, one of the monks, the Benedictine monks, I mentioned this the first night, he said what a wonderful feeling it is where if he wakes up in the morning, he's got nothing to do all day, no appointments, no work to do. What a great feeling that is. That was this morning. That was tomorrow morning. You've got nothing to do all day. It's this perfect holiday. So don't give yourself things to do and spoil the beautiful retreat. Just can't really feel like sitting. I'm just going to sit. But I've got no appointments, no schedule, no things I have to do. Don't go and say, right, tomorrow morning I'm going to get up early. I'm going to get up at 5 o'clock. I'm going to get up at 4 o'clock. I'm going to sit for an hour and a half tomorrow. No more messing around. I'm going to really do it. Oh, come on. That's really stupid stuff. Just get up tomorrow morning and enjoy every moment of your freedom. Freedom from desire. Freedom from wanting to attain things. Freedom of having to be somebody you're not. Just be yourself. Be in the moment, whatever the moment is. You feel totally free. Then you get happy. And once that happiness is there, you don't hear the footsteps. If you're struggling and striving, you'll hear every footstep, every sound, every crack in the roof. Why? Because you're so upset, you want to escape anywhere. Any distraction will do. You don't like being inside. So, that's how it works. Be happy. Can you please explain Vipassana Samadhi and Samatha Samadhi? Are they all the same? Is jhana necessary for liberation? There is no such thing as Vipassana Samadhi or Samatha Samadhi. There's only Samadhi. And Samadhi, the word, does not mean concentration. That is one of the most ridiculous translations of that term. It means stillness, not concentration. Concentration is what I was forced to do at school when the teacher was standing over me, concentrate! And to this day, the word has got a terrible meaning for me. Or it was what we did in the Second World War. We had concentration camps. And sometimes people think, my goodness, I'm now in a concentration camp because I'm supposed to do concentration meditation. This is a camp. Oh my God, what have I got myself into? This is not a concentration camp. This is a stillness. It's a happy camp. It is much more like Club Med than a concentration camp. It is Club Med. And what do I mean by that? Club meditation, serpentine. So, what samadhi means, stillness. And you know that last range retreat, one of the people who was staying here for the 3 months range retreat, which finished recently, a Chinese girl, she told me afterwards, that's amazing that you keep calling this stillness, because you know she's read the equivalent of the Pali Sutras, that's called the Agamas in Chinese. So whenever they mention the word samadhi, they never use Chinese words even remotely similar to concentration. It's the two symbols, and I probably got it the pronunciation wrong. It's shur and guan. Shur means still. Guan, as in, or guan, guanyin, means looking over, looking on. Still and mindful was the translation used in all of the Chinese texts for the word samadhi. Nothing to do with concentration. still and aware. It's beautiful to have that sort of confirmation. And once you take the word concentration away, that solves all the problems of what you think this samadhi is. And all of the terrible conflict between vipassana and samatha, that is way past its use by date. No conflict at all. Samadhi, still looking on. Samatha vipassana, combined in the one word, samadhi. So that's what we're doing. Because when we're still, then we're mindful. When we're mindful, we become still. That simile which I gave in the first evening, walking up the hillside. When you go fast, you just can't see. You're not mindful. You're not aware. Things are moving too fast. They don't fully form in your senses. When you go slower, you're more mindful. You see more. And it's more delightful. When you stop, when you're perfectly still, that is when you get the insight. That's when you see things properly. And you also get happiness too. So really, samatha, vipassana and joy, they go together. I don't know why people keep missing out the joy part. Because they miss out the joy part, they think, this is hard work. If I'm going to be enlightened, I've really got to work hard. If I'm going to have insight, I have to really work hard. If I'm going to get jhanas, I have to really work hard. Many people will be working hard, they've got no insights at all. Working hard, no stillness at all. Working hard, no happiness at all. Going in the wrong direction. Still. Sure. Maybe that's where we get the English word from. Be still. I don't know, is that true? I don't know. Any linguists here? Probably not. And guan, just looking on. It's a beautiful word. Now you know what meditation is. Be still, just look on. That's samadhi. So that's vipassana samadhi, samatha samadhi. Samadhi is both. And also sukha samadhi, happiness as well. So if you've got think you have samadhi, but haven't got a smile on your face, I'm sorry, that's not samadhi. You may be concentrating. You may be on the outside still. Just like those guards outside Buckingham Palace, they're so still. But you think they're going to get in line? Do you think they're in jhana? No way, that's total force, total control. That's not the way to meditate, not like a guard on Buckingham Palace. The way to be still is to be totally relaxed, still and just looking on, and happy. That's actually the way. And jhana necessary for liberation? Of course it is. There is an eightfold path. The last factor of the eightfold path is samasamadhi, samastillness. And that is always, every time, without exception, hundreds of times, in the suttas, the word of the Buddha, described as 1, 2, 3, 4 jhanas, and nothing else. Just jhanas. If the jhanas weren't necessary, the Buddha, in his great wisdom and compassion, would have taught us a sevenfold path. But he said an eightfold path, because every one of those factors is absolutely necessary for enlightenment. Jhanas is as necessary as your precepts. So sometimes people think, well, you know, you can cut to the chase, just do meditation and don't keep any precepts. So they only do actually a fivefold path, because three of the paths are all about precepts, about your conduct. So no, you can actually do the whole eightfold path and then you get enlightened. So yeah, jhana is necessary for liberation. No doubt about that. Any arguments? It's really nice to have an argument in the evening. It really gets people excited. Okay. And if you doubt that, I'll show you the text which, you know, from the word of the Buddha, where it says that specifically without any shadow of a doubt. When I'm tired doing meditation, bad thoughts come. What I've done was to get rid of that thought, I went to sleep. Great. Did I do bad karma by having that thought? What should I do? Should I do loving kindness meditation? Please teach how do you do loving kindness meditation. Thank you. Yeah, look, if you feel tired, then you get grumpy. When you get grumpy, you know, you tend to sort of have a bad view of things and everything is just not nice. That's what happens when you have low energy. It's one of the reasons why people get arguing with each other. If only they could just take a rest before they go, you know, shouting at people, you know, the world would be a much better place. This was even the philosopher and mathematician Laplace, 1600 and something he lived. One of the things he said, Luz and I quote this, was all the troubles of man come from not knowing how to sit still. No, that was, you know, the 17th century. So he said man, but he also meant women as well. They all come from not knowing how to sit still and rest and relax. That's a very perceptive comment by a great philosopher and mathematician. So just learning how to sit still, to rest, will solve a lot of physical and social and psychological problems. Just take it easy. Because when you're tired, you get grumpy and you do bad things you regret afterwards. So bad thoughts has come, it was just because of tiredness. It wasn't you, it was the tiredness speaking. So great, you went to sleep. Marvellous, well done, good disciple. So that's actually, you did loving kindness to your body. You needed to sleep. Could you comment on internet porn addiction? Yes, okay, internet porn addiction. I will now give a few examples. You always get a few funny questions. Internet porn addiction, it's number one, sort of, you know, the internet is something you've got to be very, there's lots of Dhamma on there. So instead of getting porn addiction, have internet Dhamma addiction, which is much more, but you know what, it's even better, because, you know, when you really get meditation, you see, I haven't mentioned this yet, you get these beautiful nimittas in your mind, these beautiful lights. So actually, you can get these actually, you know, nimittas actually on this screen. If you know, you can type in, Google in, like, nimitta, and you get this beautiful nimitta on the screen. And if you're very lucky, you can just get drawn in and get into internet jhana. Would that be a good idea? It's much better than watching porn, because that just, you know, after a while, you probably get fed up with it. That's one of the trouble with, like, the sensory desires. You know, that, you know, you start off with just ordinary stuff and it gets, you know, you have to get, it's always, what was it, the law of lesser returns. You know, what really turned you on last week, you know, is ordinary now, so you need something more. So more intense, just more extreme, more weird. And that's actually the way of the world. If you follow that path of sensory desires, it gets more and more weird every time, more and more extreme, and it, you know, just doesn't get you anywhere. So it's best actually to realize what you're doing and realize, you know, where it's going and stop before, you know, you get really caught up on it. So the best thing to do is, you know, just to realize, is that really getting me anywhere? Is that really where I want to be? And after a while you just use your wisdom. But please don't use guilt. Because sometimes the guilt is a terrible thing. I'm hopeless, I'm terrible, I'm addicted to porn, I'm awful. So, you know, I'm so hopeless I might watch some more porn. And that guilt trip is one of the biggest problems which people have. Because, you know, when you don't feel good about yourself, you can't have any restraint. You don't think you're worth anything. And that's one of the things I'm always constantly on at people about. Look, you know, it's okay. When you do come to the interviews, you will notice something. People have been coming here for years, have noticed this. You come and say all these terrible things you've been doing. And I always say, very good. It's become a joke in the monastery down the road. So you come and say, I've just been watching internet porn. I say, very good. I've just got to, you know, kill that neighbour in the room next door is always snoring and banging the doors, and I say, very good. And I do that. And the reason is I do that. You say, You know, I haven't meditated all day. So very good. You know that actually today you had a meal. Tomorrow, you're not supposed to eat in the afternoon or in the evening. But you know, tomorrow, you know, you're really hungry. You go and sneak something in there where no one else is looking. Or in the middle of the night, you go and make yourself some noodles or something. And you come up and confess to me. And I promise you, I'll say, very good. You know why I say that? It's because so many people feel guilty. They want to be punished. You know, I've done something terrible. Ajahn Brahm, please punish me. You know, Daniel, please throw me out. I don't really deserve to be in this place. I know I'm a hopeless case. And all people really need to do is to actually to have a bit of self-affirmation. That they're okay. And when you're okay, you don't make those mistakes anymore. When you've got some self-esteem, you don't need to watch porn. You don't need to sort of break all the rules. You know, psychologists know that. You know, this is self-destructive behavior. Where does that self-destructive behavior come from? Guilt. Where does guilt come from? Because too many people have been blaming you all your life. And I'm not going to do that. You may be the worst meditator I've ever had in my whole life. And I've been teaching meditation a long time. So you really have to sort of, you know, really go to levels which I don't think were possible to reach that accolade. But even if you're the very worst meditator I've ever had, you know, in this retreat or any other retreat, I will still say you're welcome. And I'll say very good. Isn't that nice? I'm not trying to encourage you to be a bad meditator or break all your rules, but I think you know what I mean. So that's what you should do. Next one. Who keeps a record of all our rights and wrongs in this life? Someone is watching you. Big Brother. It's actually not Big Brother, it's Santa. And so if you have done too many wrongs, you won't get any Christmas presents this year. You know, that's it. Again, that's one of those other things which are really sort of imbibed into us from a very early age. That, you know, that someone is watching us all the time. We have to do, you know, what's right and what's wrong. Here's a nice story for you. There was, this is an Indian Hindu story, but, you know, I love it as a Buddhist. Actually, well, my goodness, I'm taking so much time on these things. We don't want to go to bed tonight, we'll just carry on until breakfast. Look, I've only done a few here. Anyway, just a story. There was a teacher, one of these old Indian teachers a long time ago. And in those days, the one teacher would be wise about so many things, and they teach a whole heap of students, maybe a dozen, 15 or so, and teach them everything until when they graduated, they'd all leave, and then he'd get a new group of students. So he had this whole group of students for many years. And also, because it's one of these old stories, had the beautiful daughter. She was so hot that all the students really, you know, they liked her. And in those days, you know, there was no such thing as, you know, choosing your own partner. You know, the family would decide who you married. And so one day the teacher said, "Look, I've got this one daughter, and I know you all like her. She's very beautiful, a wonderful character. And being her father, I have to make a decision on who she'll marry. And I've got to make that decision soon. And usually it should be the best student. So in order to find out which one of you is the best student and who will marry my daughter, I'll give you a test. It's a test of wisdom and obedience. So this is your test. I want you, in the next 7 days, to go to the villages surrounding here and steal as much as you can. Because I've got another problem. You know, I have to give a dowry for my daughter. I haven't got enough money for that. Whoever marries my daughter, you have to get a house, you know, set yourselves up, and it's very expensive. So I want you to all go around, steal whatever you can, and whoever steals the most will marry the daughter, will also get all the loot. And he said, oh, one important thing, make sure that no one sees you steal. And whoever steals the most will get my daughter. You know, all the students were really surprised, because that was a very, very good teacher who was usually very moral. And now he was telling them to steal. But obedience was such in those days, whatever your teacher said, you had to follow. And actually, they all wanted to marry the daughter. So the next nights, they snuck into the houses, trying to keep the teacher's instructions, not to make sure that no one saw them steal. So they'd wait until everyone fell asleep or they left, and they'd crawl in and steal this and steal that and bring it back to their teacher. And when they brought it back, the teacher kept a careful, meticulous record who stole what, so he could find out who stole the most and also from which house. And after 7 days, he called the meeting to give the results of the test. And he said, "You've all stolen so much stuff, much more than I expected. You've done a really good job. All except one of you who hasn't stolen anything at all. Why?" And this poor little student came up and said, "Because I followed your instructions. Well, I told you to steal. But Master, you told us to make sure that no one saw me steal. But all the others did that as well. They crept into the houses when people were asleep or when they'd left. Didn't you do that?" He said, "Oh yes, I did that too, Master. I crept in when people had all left, but as I was about to take the thing, I realized someone was looking." "Who was that?" said the Master. "Me," said the student. "I was seeing me steal. Therefore, I couldn't follow your instructions." And the Master said, "Thank goodness I've got one smart disciple amongst all you stupid guys. I am rich enough, I don't need all this stuff. You can all take it back. Here's the list of where it belongs. And don't worry, you won't get punished because I told all the villagers a couple of weeks ago to expect you." And only one person realized that you can't steal without someone watching you. And who's watching you? Yourself, yes. So the answer is to the question, who keeps a record of all our rights and wrongs in this life? Yourself, you do. And you can't escape from that. So what should you do? You've kept a record of all your rights and all your wrongs. Have you? Actually, most of you just kept a record of your wrongs. Your rights you've forgotten about. So, change your mind. Like I said with the simile of the photographic albums. All the bad things you've done. Remember what you should do? How many of you did that? Put your hand up if you wrote all those bad things on a piece of toilet paper and flushed it down the toilet yesterday. Hooray! 1, 2 people did. Hooray! You're the great disciples. You can go to bed now, or you rest for in detention while I finish this. Bad things. Oh, you're in denial. That's the first wrong thing. Okay. This last question, it comes up, it's amazing. Can one flush the past down the toilet without forgiving on or forgiveness? Or is it flush and forget? Yeah, flush and forget, that is forgiveness. What forgiveness means is no punishment. You acknowledge. Forgive means amnesty. Call it amnesty and it makes it much easier to understand. Amnesty, yeah, you tell exactly what you've done. And there's no punishment at all. And then the third thing is learn from it. So you don't make the same mistake again. So you don't cause so much hurt to yourself and others again. Those are the three things to do. Acknowledge, forgive, and learn. And that's what the Buddha said. He said, as long as you acknowledge and learn from it, he said that this is called growth in the Aryan Vinaya, the Aryan discipline. And it was so refreshing when I read that as a young man, coming from a society which is all about guilt and punishment. You know, like in fact, please excuse me, but Christianity, you know, you women, you're guilty because you made Adam eat the apple and they haven't stopped punishing you since. That's absolutely crazy stuff. You know, you don't even have to be a Christian. But, you know, you made Adam eat the apple, so women are sort of cursed from this day on. Absolutely crazy stuff. And you're all sinners. So, you know, I used to have fun with the Christians. Are you a sinner? I said, yeah, I'm a sinner. It's just so weird and pathetic. No, it's just, and people get into that guilt trip. And we think we're worthless. Now, how long did women have to fight to realize they weren't worthless? Gays and lesbians. For centuries, they thought they were abominations, something wrong with them. They were worthless, demeaned, diminished. There's something really evil about that. And now, about you've done something wrong, and you feel you're not worth anything. You're demeaned, diminished. Come on. That is not the wise way to live a life. It's not compassionate, it's not wise, it's not sensible. So whatever you've done, you just forgive it. Total amnesty. You don't need punishment. Acknowledging and learn from it. Once you learn from it, you don't do it again. It's as simple as that. And that means there's growth in your own discipline. You know, I'll just finish off here that sometimes people ask, you know, in Buddhism, is there heaven and hells? There are heaven and hells. Who sends you down to hell? And what's it like down there? If you go to the temples in Sri Lanka, in Burma, in Thailand, you see all these pictures of these big vats and people boiling in the vats and these beings who look, you know, like something out of a Steven Spielberg movie or a cartoon book, poking you with sticks, going up the Tree of Swords or whatever. And that was, people actually loved looking at those paintings, because in those days before they had movies, that was, you know, they got off on this. I don't know why it is that people like going to torture chambers. I remember the Madame Tussauds gallery had more people going to the Chamber of Horrors than any other part of the gallery. There's something weird about people, they like to see sort of suffering. So in those days, that was the entertainment. They painted it on the temple wall so people could watch all this stuff. And I looked at that stuff and I sort of wondered, 25 centuries have gone by since then. You know, torture has got much more advanced. There's much better ways of torturing people than poking them with sticks. In fact, you know, please, this is for you and Robin, all the people from Penang. 2 or 3 years ago, that was actually 2 years ago, when I went to Penang to do the 9-day retreat, I'm going again next month. It was Christmas night, and after finishing the talk, you know, up in the hall at the top, and I went back to my room, it was about 10:30, and just on the opposite side of the road, they're having a party for Christmas night. A karaoke party. My God, that was suffering. You know, I've been teaching all day. I was tired. I wanted a rest. And people were singing this karaoke. And it's the first time I've heard karaoke. What you do, first of all, you have to be drunk, first of all. And then they think they can, like, sing, like, you know, Frank Sinatra or, like, you know, Barbara Streisand or something. And they can't. And it's out of tune. It's, you know, they forget the words, it's screaming, and it's, you know, if you're drunk, you don't notice it. But for sober people like me, like monks, it was such suffering. And I didn't finish till about 1 o'clock, I forget what the time it was, and then I get up early in the morning, so I didn't get much sleep that night. But I realized that if ever the worst type of hell in the whole world will be the karaoke hell. Forget about being boiled in his big tubs and his demons poking you with sticks. Karaoke hell is much worse than that. So, yeah, there are hells. You make them up for how you think you deserve to be punished. So if I was a bad monk, that's what I would do. I'd send myself to the karaoke hell, you bad monk. You know, take that for a while. But why would you send yourself to those places anyway? It's not someone else doesn't send you there. You do. You send yourself there. Because you're stupid enough to think you need to be punished. And you seek for punishment. and you make up the punishment for what you think you deserve, for how long you deserve. The gates of hell are always open. Always open. You can walk out any time you want. People don't like to, because they think they don't deserve to be happy. And you can send yourself to heaven. You can make up your own heaven. For me, you know, have you seen the pictures of heaven in the temple paintings or read about them in the sutras? They sound very boring to me. They can be a much better place. They have ambrosia in heaven. I want fish and chips. They have harp music. I prefer Jimi Hendrix. Can we have some Elvis, please? Don't step on my blue suede shoes. If you like Elvis, you can make a heaven and Elvis will be playing every night. You make your heaven. You actually construct it. These are mind-made realms. And you send yourself up there because you think you deserve it. You give yourself a break. You send yourself to hell if you don't know about forgiveness. And no one else can forgive you. You can pray to the Buddha, to Kuan Yin, to Jesus, all you like. No one will ever be able to forgive you. Only you. You know, the person you hurt, the person you were cruel to, you go up to them and they'll say, look, I forgive you. It doesn't really work. It helps. But what's most important is you forgive yourself. You let it go. And that was such a wonderful relief and refreshing to see that in the Dhamma, in Buddhism, that's what you do. You forgive you. Give yourself a break. Acknowledge. Forgive. No more punishment. Total amnesty. And learn. It's a growing experience. You made a mistake. Learn from it. But no punishment. And that's so beautiful. And that means you never send yourself to hell anymore. You can just enjoy nice heavens. In this life while you're still alive and also when you die. Even now people live in hell. They can't forgive themselves for what they've done. Why? Does that really help anybody? Punishing yourself? Don't forgive yourself. Let it go. Write it on the piece of toilet paper. Flush it down the toilet. Have done with it. And then you can be happy and peaceful and just move forward in life rather than always move backwards. So that's the toilet simile. And there may be some people who want to go to the toilet. So I better finish off now, otherwise I'm going to get into trouble. It's 9:20. You have 20 more minutes. There are still heaps and heaps more questions inside here. Look at them all. So what I'll do with these, I'll take them to the toilet. No, well, I'll leave it here until tomorrow morning. So tomorrow afternoon, evening, whatever it is. And so we'll deal with these tomorrow evening. And you can put some more in here. And at the end of the week, what doesn't get answered, we can throw them away afterwards. If your karma is good, your questions will be answered. If your karma is terrible, they will not. And so that's just tough luck. So have a nice evening and just have a nice rest. See you in the morning. Those of you who've got energy, you can stay and meditate some more. If you're tired, you can go take rest. So be kind. So 1, 2, 3. Sadhu. 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 Okay, now let's do the sadhu practice. Because that was very weak and pathetic. So whatever you do, give it everything you've got. That's what Ajahn Chah taught me. Really put effort into it. If you're going to meditate, really meditate. If you're going to eat, eat. If you're going to sleep, sleep. So sadhus, you really give energy, okay? Sadhu. 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 Isn't that fun? Okay, we'll have some more sadhu practices tomorrow morning. Okay, good night, everyone.